Welcome to the North and South of Things podcast, a show dedicated to discussion of topics important to the LGBT community and the community at large. Here are your hosts, Mark and George. Hey kids, it's George in Atlanta. Welcome to another episode of the North and South of Things. Joining me today is our co-host, Mark, in St. Paul, Minnesota. Mark, how are you?
I am fabulous, George. It's such a beautiful day with bright, sunny, cold sunshine outside. It makes me feel all warm, especially when I stay indoors.
We do love staying indoors, especially in the 45-degree weather we have here. I wish it were snowing, but maybe another day. Mark, we're going to talk about a really odd topic today. I'm sure most of our listeners, if not all, have heard of the Iran-Contra affair. You'll recall that that was a unauthorized, illegal arms deal concocted by the CIA to sell missiles to the Iranian government in exchange for hostages they were holding. With the proceeds of that deal, the dollars from that deal going to the Contra rebels in Nicaragua who were trying to overthrow a socialist regime there. Early on, President Reagan wanted to help the Contras, but Congress, which I believe was a democratically controlled Congress at the time, said no, passed a law that said, no, you can't spend money at the Contras. So the CIA, supposedly Reagan had no knowledge of it, the CIA concocted this deal with Iran and involved Israel as well, and they got caught. So everybody's familiar with that story, but I don't think many people realize there's a whole nother scheme underway, and that's our topic for today, the disgracing of Gary Webb, a journalist with the San Jose Mercury News. Tell us about the movie you recently saw on this topic.
Okay, well, the movie of his book is called Kill the Messenger, and I did not realize that this movie was filmed in Atlanta. So we have a little connection there, but there's a phenomenal, powerful performance by actor Jeremy Renner, and it's really a riveting, it's fact-based thriller, and it chronicles the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Gary Webb's investigation of the CIA's use of cocaine profits to secretly fund the Nicaraguan Contra rebels in the 1980s. And it's based on his book called Dark Alliance by Gary Webb, and Kill the Messenger is by filmmaker Nick Shu. And so this is a phenomenal story. I had known a little bit about the Iran-Contra affair, but this movie, which is really accessible, basically breaks down the story where Gary Webb, who is an investigative reporter with the San Jose Mercury News, he learns CIA is complicit in the smuggling of massive amounts of cocaine into the country, which he suggested led to the birth of crack cocaine in Los Angeles, and specifically in the African American community.
Yeah. South Central LA and Compton. Yeah.
So the Washington Post, LA Times, and New York Times trashed this investigative piece and undermined the story, presumably because they had been scooped by the likes of, you know, the San Jose Mercury News. Now, according to the movie, the CIA and the newspaper retaliated by making Webb the story. And I think we can kind of draw the parallel that this is often the case in journalism today, where they try to discredit his story by exposing his personal and past failings.
The movie does a really good job at pointing out, I mean, because he's not a perfect man, has made some bonehead decisions in his life, but that doesn't mean he's not a good journalist.
That's right. And I think we all make mistakes in our lives that maybe perhaps we wouldn't like to have it see the light of day.
But he also made a bit of a mistake in that he couldn't get any of the and for his three-part series, he couldn't get any of his CIA confidants on record, which I think, you know, is what also cast some doubt on his story.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, this sort of stress and, you know, Sturm und Drang of the drama of this, you know, he basically, this has a cost in his own life. And he separates from his wife, and he's forced to take a new post with the San Jose paper in a bureau that's out, you know, in the suburbs, basically. Mm-hmm. And he's relegated to covering stories about traffic cop horses.
Right.
So
yeah,
he eventually quits the paper. But in the process of this, he is nominated and accepts the Journalist of the Year award, but ends up being fully ostracized from his professional colleagues.
I have to say, it's a very compelling movie. It's very it's filled with sort of intrigue, and I love all these kinds of movies, those that are fact based, that they're rooted in some real life situation, mm-hmm. and that there's a lot of usually government or international. I love all this stuff. So this movie was right up my alley. I have to say, the way the newspapers reacted, their competitors. First of all, I don't think they are competitors, right? San Jose Mercury News is not as big a paper as LA Times or New York Times or even the Washington Post, right? So I'm perplexed as to why they reacted so harshly. Were they embarrassed that they got scooped? Were they jealous? You know, so what happened? Let's back up and say what those papers did. All three of those papers assigned a massive number of reporters within their organization to pick through his three-part series and find every I he didn't dot and every T he didn't cross. And you know, the way the movie tells the story, you know, people he interviewed, even those he got and mentioned in name, they would then go back to them, and that person would have changed their story a little bit. You know, I work with the media and have for 20 years, and I can assure you there have been more than one occasion when I've been interviewed that words are in print that I don't feel like I actually said. You know, there was an example of my first article when I worked at the hospital. We were launching a new program, and I'm reading in the paper that I said, in answer to the reporter's question, do you think you can blah, 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 blah? And I said, yeah, I think that's doable. I've never used the word doable in my life, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I'm quite certain that anybody that's interviewed, when they see a lengthy amount of text in print, are going to take some issue with the way a reporter wrote it down and remembered it, and then it appeared in the paper. So I'm not surprised that people changed their, you know, or if the CIA got to that person and said, yeah, we're going to make your life a living hell if you, you know, if you don't retract that statement. So I'm not surprised that there were some backtracking from some of his sources. But I don't get why these papers spent so much time and money to really hammer him. I mean, what's in it for them? I think it's CIA collusion. Is that the right word? Collusion?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think they were in concert with the CIA, because they all have contacts at the CIA and need those contacts to move forward. To be able to get stories out. So I think they were, one, embarrassed, you know, that they got scooped by this little paper. And mm-hmm. two, I think, you know, it was all, their relationships with the CIA were just all too convenient, you know, at that time.
Well, I think if you look at how this story unfolded and you watch the film, I know after it ended, I had this feeling that we still don't know the full story.
Right.
And something is rotten in Denmark here, you know, especially with how this story eventually ended with Gary Webb.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't sit well with me, especially the final note on the film.
Yeah. So we're going to jump around here because some of this is kind of hard to talk about in proper chronological order. First of all, we remember the timing of the Iran-Contra affair, mid-85 to 87. I can't pinpoint exactly when this activity happened, but I feel like it was about the same time as the actual arms deal, was the impression I get. Gary's story was not the first story to talk about this notion of there being some connection between the CIA and drug smugglers in Nicaragua, or, you know, in that part of the world. So the San Francisco Examiner is pointed out as having done a story, and I think there's at least two other stories, including the New York Times. So it's not the first time that, I mean, it's not like he brought up the notion that there was some connection and that that was the scandal. The crux of why they went after him was he made the connection between the drug dealer that was pushing crack on the streets, made that connection directly to CIA informants and CIA staff. So he drew the parallel, I mean, drew connected the dots and said, oh, the CIA is responsible for the crack epidemic, you know. And I don't think folks can underestimate how the impact of, you have cocaine that's been cut with baking soda or baking powder or something to make it far cheaper, and it's immediately available to people with very low incomes in a level they can afford, and it's available to them around every corner. I mean, millions and millions and millions of dollars in the mid '80s to make this drug accessible. And that's the part that people went after him for, was because he basically accused, he drew the connection. He drew the connection. There's some contention about whether or not he actually said the CIA is responsible for the crack epidemic. I mean, he's simply drawing the connection. The guy who's selling, Rick Ross, is that his name? Freeway Rick Ross? The guy who's pushing this, first of all, is a guy who was in prison for other drug crimes but miraculously got out. Wonder how that happened. Two, you can connect him to other people that are listed in court documents and CIA reports. So it doesn't take a brain surgeon to connect those dots, you know. It has since this time, so let's go through that timeline again. 85, 87, Iran-Contra affair, about the same time, this drug smuggling activity. And then his reporting was a full decade later, 1996, right? So there have been now published reports acknowledging, albeit in a very obfuscated manner, the fact that the CIA was, in fact, let me read you their admittal. I'm quoting here, and this quote is from a New York Times article. In 1998, Frederick Hitz, the CIA's inspector general, testified before the House Intelligence Committee that after looking into the matter at length, he believed the CIA was a bystander or worse on the drugs in the war on drugs. Quoting again, "Let me be frank about what we're finding," he said. "There are instances where the CIA did not, in an expeditious and consistent fashion, cut off relationships with individuals supporting the Contra program who were alleged to have engaged in drug trafficking activity, or take action to resolve these allegations." So in as circular way as they can, I think they've admitted. Would you say that's an admittance?
It was an admittance. And, you know, there was another lengthy report that came out about this same time. But you have to put it into context of when this other information came out. The country also had kind of the one topic news item of the day that everyone was fixated on. And this sort of information and this admission of wrongdoing or, you know, shady dealings came out when the Monica Lewinsky affair was happening with then President Bill Clinton.
Right.
So,
and that's all people wanted to talk about at that time.
Yeah, exactly. So they didn't want to revisit or tie up any loose ends, so to speak, on this story. They were looking for that next big thing. And I think this is one of the reasons why the story kind of gets buried in that sensationalistic one, you know, one news topic sort of model that we have even to today.
And there were some, and to your point, there were some reports, there were some early reports that had enough information in there that pointed out some of these linkages to these drug traffickers, that it was, I mean, you have it there in print, you know, it's, and because the Monica Lewinsky blue dress was more important than these reports, it never got picked up. It never got reported. I mean, a scant amount of reporting on this, which mm-hmm. which should have been, you know, earth shattering, you know.
Well, it should have been above the fold.
Yes.
And, you know, it was in section G.
Right. Right.
You know.
So here's where the papers stand on this issue now, right? We're a full, and of course, what's brought all this up is the movie Mark mentioned, Kill the Messenger. With Jeremy Renner. So all of these articles are popping back up now with, you know, in the last couple of years. The articles, the movie was released last year in 2014. So one of the leading editors at the LA Times, who was responsible for this hack job on Gary Webb, he has apologized, right? So that's one of the three. Mm-hmm. The New York Times never really apologized, but the movie review of Kill the Messenger was written by a guy who writes on the confluence of media and public life, right? So I don't think he's like a regular movie reviewer, but he's a media critic. So his article is as much as an apology as you're probably going to get from the New York Times. I mean, the headline says, "Resurrecting a Disgraced Reporter. Kill the Messenger recalls a reporter wrongly disgraced." That sounds like an apology to me.
Yeah, well, it's certainly accurate.
Right, exactly. and then a person with the Washington Post wrote that the newspaper, and I'm quoting here, showed more passion for sniffing out the flaws of the San Jose's answer than for sniffing out a better answer for themselves. Mm-hmm. So in one way or another, you still have, I mean, you have all three papers acknowledging in some way they didn't do the right thing, you know, by going after this guy. And they destroyed, you know, they destroyed him. There's also, I want to point out, I believe apoplectic is the word I'm trying to find. This makes me so enraged. So 2 weeks after this Washington Post person made this comment, her name is Geneva Overholzer or something like that. I don't know her role, but they listed her as the quote ombudsman for the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. She's the one who made the quote about we should have been sniffing out a better answer for ourselves. 2 weeks after she's quoted in that article, there's an op-ed piece from Jeff Lean at the Washington Post, and the headline is, "Gary Webb was no journalism hero despite what Kill the Messenger says." And he goes on a huge tirade of how they were all justified in doing what they're doing. And I'm like, wow, even with all the information you have now,
yeah,
basically, you know, hey, we did it. From the CIA and multiple reports, you're still going to stand up and say that the Post did the right thing. There's 500 responses, comments to that article. And I wouldn't say necessarily trolls. I mean, these are people who seem to write well and have some composed thoughts. And not a one of them are defending his op-ed. They're all trashing him. And there's a great response that we'll put on our website from a website called Consortium News. It doesn't look like a terribly mainstream news source, but the response to his op-ed is pretty brilliant. Yeah. So what are some of the other underlying issues we've talked about here? We picked on the papers. I mean, that's a huge issue. At minimum, they've acted inappropriately. At worst, they colluded with the CIA to cover this up and to cast doubt on Webb's story. What do you think of the fact that San Jose eventually walked back the story and abandoned him?
You know, I think that's reprehensible and deplorable.
And cowardly.
Because, and cowardly, because when you expect a journalist who has an editor, you know, has an assignment editor, has an editor and a news director, and they're all telling you to write the story, and you write that story, and they come back and abandon you, that's a serious breach of ethics in my part.
Yeah.
If you've published something and you're an editor and you go ahead and print publish on whatever it is that your journalist is doing, you have an ethical obligation to stand by that reporter. Mm-hmm. And they didn't. And I think that's just, it's shameful.
I don't know if I saw it in one of the many articles I've read or if it was referenced in the movie, but the inference was that the editor and some of the other people at the San Jose Mercury News were kind of looking out for themselves. Like, if you are in that paper and you're still in your career trajectory and you might want to bow to the LA Times or the New York Times or the Washington Post because you may want to work there someday. And I'm like, Right. Yeah, I can see that. I can see why that might have played a role. Doesn't make it any more correct. But, you know, some of the big picture things that you mentioned earlier juxtapose this notion of the CIA and the Reagan administration, with the Reagan administration's knowledge, smuggling drugs into this country to sell, to fund the Iran, to fund the Contra rebels. Juxtapose that to his wife and her primary message during his presidency of just say no to drugs.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, like, on one out of one side of your face, you're talking about the evils of drug use, and on the other side of your face, you're fucking causing it.
I think we call that hypocrisy.
Yeah, exactly. Definition defined. Exactly. I'm also annoyed that, you know, if you compare what we did to President Clinton for his inappropriate discretions mm-hmm. of a sexual nature, which quite frankly are none of my business and I don't really care about and I don't want to hear about it, you know, mm-hmm. juxtapose that to the fact that Reagan got off scot-free, claiming, you know, plausible deniability and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But then ultimately took to their airwaves and said, you know, I accept personal responsibility. Great. Where were the... You know, yeah. Where were the congressional hearings? Where were the, you know, impeachment hearings? You know, nothing. And then Bush daddy, what's his name? George Herbert Walker.
Mm-hmm.
Pardons six of the major. Who all was in that? Was that like G. Gordon Liddy? No, wait, that's Watergate. Oliver North, Poindexter. Yeah. Oh, and Caspar Weinberger.
Mm-hmm.
Only the at that time, was he defense secretary?
I believe so.
Yeah. I mean, it was Caspar Weinberg. He's played a big role. Yeah, so I know he was one of the six. And that was after a six-year inquiry that was ongoing. And mm-hmm. granted, I'm sure they were grandstanding and trying to prevent it from happening. But yeah. The other thing I think is important to remember that might have played some, they deny this, but that might have played some role in why the newspapers responded the way they did. This happened in 1996. Wasn't that the birth of the internet?
it really was. I mean, the World Wide Web, I believe, launched shortly before that.
Yeah, yeah. So they had this article, as they pointed out in the movie. This series was published with a really scathing piece of artwork. It was somebody smoking a crap pipe right in the middle of the CIA logo. So, I mean, it basically, mm-hmm. you know,
yeah.
made the connection.
It's a great logo.
Yeah, yeah. And what was interesting is this is the first time major media had a story online with all the supporting documentation. And I think it did make the other papers look silly. Here you got this mm-hmm. little San Jose Daily newspaper, you know, putting up Pulitzer Prize winning stuff, you know,
mm-hmm.
Well, he didn't win a Pulitzer for this, though, did he? That was not the award he got. It was like a state association or something like that. Yeah,
mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. This is it's a very disturbing story, especially when you start thinking about all the implications of it. Mm-hmm. I love what the movie director said in I think the same New York Times article. I'm quoting again. There were many things that went wrong. He added, the packaging of the story, how it was received and grew, the fact that he was not backed up by his editors, but I was struck by the fact that journalism, which had been the source of his purpose, his bliss, turned on him. It's tragic. End quote. Yeah.
I think that is a really, you know, stark point. Where you have someone who's involved in investigative journalism who breaks this story but doesn't have the support.
Yeah. If you doubt for a minute that this is a spoiler, right?
Right.
That's
right. So if here's your spoiler alert.
Yeah.
If you don't want to hear this very last section of the show and you want to see this film for yourself, turn off your iPod now.
Yeah. Okay, you've been warned. So if you doubt this guy's life was ruined in 2004, 7 years to the day after his resignation at the paper, Webb committed suicide. Shot himself twice in the head.
Well, and here's what I think. I know a little bit about suicide.
Mm-hmm.
And to shoot yourself in the head twice.
Right.
I'm sorry. I can't really accept that.
Yeah. I've read a couple bits about addressing that point. And there's one story that says the first shot went through his cheek and therefore he had the ability to do it again. Mm-hmm. But I'm with you. I mean,
well, in the movie, yeah. There is a section where he's up very late at night and he hears somebody out in the yard and someone is by his beloved little sports car. And you get the idea, it's inferred that somebody is tampering
mm-hmm.
with his brakes or with his car in some way. So you have that aspect in the film, and then you come to know at the end that he commits suicide and shoots himself in the head twice.
Yeah.
What?
Yeah, and he's that scene you're describing, he calls the police. And the police come, and they're outside taking his statement. And you see two guys dressed in black walking into the house, not in police uniform, in suits. You know, CIA operatives.
Mm-hmm.
Walk into his house, down to his basement office, thumbing through all of his papers. His son comes in and sees this. They don't flash a badge or anything. They're just, you know, and the son mm-hmm. is... wisely, you know, alarmed, like, why are you just rifling through my dad's stuff? Because they weren't being careful at all. They were looking through it and looking through pages and throwing books down and all this kind of stuff. And so he notifies his dad. He screams for his dad, and his dad comes down and he's like, the fuck are you doing? And you would expect them to say, yeah. This is an investigation, it's a crime scene. He's like, no, it's not a crime scene, you know. And he mm-hmm. tells them to get out, and they leave, and they don't have any appearance to be connected with the police, is the point.
Right.
Know? So there's good reason to believe, if we're to believe what we see in the movie, that he was. I mean, why would you not think he was being tailed or watched or surveilled by the CIA? Of course mm-hmm. he was. Of course he was. So, yeah, highly good reason to be suspicious of the two gunshot But it also wouldn't surprise me if it was truly suicide, to be honest. I mean, the guy's life was ruined. His wife, he and his wife separated. His son was not happy with him. He couldn't, the only job he could get was with a small paper, some alternative newspaper that he couldn't even pay his mortgage. I mean, his life was ruined. I mean, he had such a passion for journalism, and you take that away from him, and, you know, there's no hope in his mind. So, I'm not going to rule out that it was suicide, but I think there's an equally likely scenario.
Right. I mean, it's plausible in either direction.
Yeah. Yeah. What do you think about, with all of this in mind, and given where we are with corporate media today, where everything seems to be watered down or fair and balanced. What do you think about the state of investigative journalism today?
I think it's in a shambles. It's very expensive. Okay. There's no doubt about it. Having worked for a media organization that had a newsroom, I can tell you it is not cheap to send these people out to do a good investigative journalist role within their communities.
It's because you kind of have to let the story take you where it takes you.
That's right.
Which could be in Colombia or, you know, or over a span of 2 years. I mean, like, you just never know.
That's right. And I think there's a greater need for it now.
Yeah.
In today's world, but I'm not sure we're getting it. There are little glimpses of it happening. Yeah. I just heard recently that there's a reporter who writes for a Michigan newspaper who is kind of breaking some of the other issues that are happening with Flint, Michigan, and the lead in the water supply that's been happening for 2 solid years.
That's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous.
And, you know, so I think it's happening. I really think it needs to be kind of a coordinated effort. And frankly, I don't see a lot of news organizations stepping forward and saying we're going to fill this role.
Yeah. Yeah. No, they don't. Well, I shouldn't say no, because here in Atlanta, one of the more popular things to go and rail on about is, you know, this investigative journalism bit. But it's so bent toward government, and it's so bent toward local government, you know, we're going to hold the powerful accountable. And I'm like, that's great and everything, but I can guarantee you corporations are just, if not more powerful than the government. So I'd like to hear you holding the Koch brothers accountable. I'd like to hear you hold corporate media accountable. I don't think all corporate media is evil. I don't believe that. I don't think they're all whitewashing everything, but I am alarmed. I am concerned, because corporations are out for one thing and one thing only, and that is money. That's why they exist, and I'm not demonizing them for it. Let's be clear. That's what they're there to do. But that's not the role of media. The role of media is not to make money. But all major media outlets are owned by major corporations. You know, I think we need more ProPublica of the world, you know, which is a great website that offers a lot of investigative reporting. And I think they're nonpartisan. I'm sure you could, you know, lean a left, you know, sentiment toward it. But they kept a crap ton of data about all of the recovery programs, the dollars in the Republic, all the HERA legislation and all the other recovery bits of legislation, and they tracked all those dollars and who was spending them and what state was getting them and how they were being used. And so, I mean, that was nonpartisan, I thought, and I think they are fairly balanced in that regard. But I still don't think we have found an affordable model to combat the state of corporate media, and that's troublesome to me, because I feel like it's so less expensive to run a media operation digitally and electronically than it is print, isn't it? You've been in that.
Yeah, Yeah, it is. And, you know, media is changing so rapidly. I mean, it's hard to navigate. You know, newspapers are expensive.
Yeah.
And then you have some things that happen, like in Las Vegas, for example, where, you know, there's a secret buyer who who basically buys this paper and sets loose journalists to investigate judges and other political officials because they've got an axe to grind.
Yeah.
That's not right.
Yeah. Yeah, we could go on, kids.
we could
really go on this topic. I believe in the media. I believe in a free press. I believe that some of the corporate media folks, you know, are fairly well funded and do a decent job. But I'm increasingly alarmed, to say the least.
And I think what really alarms me is a lot of the good quality journalism that is happening behind paywalls, which means that you have to pay in order to get this information. And I don't think that is right either.
Well, here's a little class assignment for you. Go to AJC.com, the free website, and then go to myAJC.com and just notice the stark difference between the two. To say nothing of the content that's behind the paywall, just notice the appearance of the two. And I love the AJC, and I think they do some great work, and they've got a great history. But I worry about that issue exactly, which is what they're doing for the paid accounts versus the non-paid accounts, and how we're dumbing down the news and focusing on trivial stuff and house fires when we're not talking about community development or legislation. You know what I mean? I'm like, that salacious stuff is interesting, and everybody wants to know who's sleeping with who. But we've got a city here that needs to be run well. Can we, you know, can we focus on some of that stuff? And to be sure, they do that in the AJC.com website too. But the MyAJC has a different flavor and appeal and attractiveness to it, let alone actual content variations. And they have experimented, to their credit, they have experimented with, they keep trying to tweak to find that balance. Because I don't think you're ever going to get to a point where all news is free. No. I mean, they have to exist.
Somebody has to pay for it somewhere.
Yeah, those reporters aren't working voluntarily. I mean, like, they need, they got a car payment and they got a retirement to worry about too, you know? So, and part of that is what the internet's doing to us. If it's on the internet, it should be free, you know? And that's not always the case. We want everything for free. Anyway, Mark, we've run over, as per usual. I have failed in my job to crack a whip and keep us on schedule. But hopefully it's been an interesting topic, and folks will, appreciate, the content and will forgive us. We'll try and be better next time. Any final thoughts?
You know, find news, be informed.
Yeah.
It's kind of your job as a citizen.
It is indeed. All right, kids, until next time, Mark, have a great day.
You too, George.
Thank you for listening to this episode of The North and South of Things. More information available at northandsouthofthings.com. Follow Mark on Twitter at Laughing Buddha. That's LaughingBuddha. And George at George in Atlanta. Our podcast theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.